Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to this podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
This podcast discusses domestic violence, criminal behavior, murder, and adult themes. While not explicit, listener discretion is advised. Apprehension knotted up Catherine Terry's insides on the drive over Snoqualmie Pass. It was late November 1999. Catherine's boyfriend Dennis was at the wheel of his Mitsubishi Galant, heading west toward Seattle. Rain pounded the windshield, making it hard to see the mountain road. The wipers swept back and forth at what seemed a frantic speed. Catherine was ready for the drive to be over, but she wasn't looking forward to what awaited her in Seattle. Her ex-boyfriend, Josh Powell.
You know, he could be so good, he could be so sweet and loving, and then if things weren't going his way, not so much.
Catherine dated Josh long before he became the subject of a murder investigation. In fact, the story she's about to tell happened almost exactly 10 years before Susan Powell vanished. She's never told it to anyone aside from friends and family. Not police, not reporters, not anyone.
I wonder, and I do wonder in the back of my mind, I'm like, I wonder if Josh thought that I would resurface and blow his whole cover. But I'm just like, I don't want to deal with him. I don't want to deal with the repercussions of him sicking his family on me.
I found Catherine by scouring thousands of files recovered from Josh's computer. He mentioned her by name only a couple of times, having intentionally erased almost every trace of her from his journals. Catherine broke her silence with me for the very first time. But back to the story. In November of 99, Catherine hadn't yet told her new boyfriend, Dennis, much about Josh. She'd only told him Josh had been very controlling.
Yeah, it's just like, I didn't realize at the time, of course, how isolated I had become. I think I built up in my mind that I was happy. Things could only get better, and eventually we would get married, and things would be better after that.
It was afternoon before they made it to Seattle, but already starting to get dark. They found a hotel a few miles north of downtown. Catherine called Josh to arrange a time and place to meet. She'd broken up with him over the phone months earlier, in March, during a trip home to Utah.
He didn't yell or anything like that. He's just really quiet. And he was just like, okay, he goes, what do you want to do with your stuff? And I'm like, well, go ahead and stick it in storage and I'll come up and get it.
So that's what Josh had done. In the meantime, she'd met Dennis. They'd fallen in love. Catherine knew she needed to go back to Washington at some point to get her stuff. When she called Josh to let him know she was coming up in November, she told him her fiancé would be with her. But Dennis and Catherine weren't actually engaged.
I think it was better that we told him that we were engaged instead of, oh, this is my boyfriend, you know, because then he'd been like, insert Josh, let me see if I can break this up.
Josh insisted he needed to see Catherine that very night. He said he wanted to give her a pass to the Pacific Science Center.
I do remember telling him, I don't think we're going to use it, but he said, I'm going to come drop it off anyways. But no, I really think it was his way of checking out the situation.
Josh showed up at the hotel about 11 p.m. He knocked on the door. It swung open, revealing a tall, broad-shouldered man, Dennis Everett.
I stood in the doorway. I'm 6'1". He was about 5'10". He was a lot smaller than I am. And I stood in the doorway like this. And she's peeking over my shoulder, like kind of standing on her tiptoes and peeking over my shoulder.
And I was like, hey.
Just taking in the whole conversation.
Yeah.
Josh's eyes grew wide. He said, well, you must be Dennis.
And he was being all cool and cordial. He didn't seem anything like what she had described to me. And still, I didn't know half the stuff that I would find out that came out later.
Josh handed over the Science Center pass as promised. Then he and Catherine agreed to make the handoff of her belongings the next day. We're going to get back to Dennis and Catherine in just a little bit. First, though, we need to talk about Josh. Josh had a long history of failing to connect with girls. His written journals are full of entries about struggles in dating. His audio journals are even more telling. Here he is, in his own voice, reacting to one rejection.
To lose such a good friend, I didn't want it to end. I know you're in a better place, but it's still so broke my heart. And now when you hugged your brother, you sent him to me. And he filled me up. He replaced my broken heart with incredible joy. Some of the greatest joy you could possibly imagine. You taught me so much about where I want to be. And especially how to take care of people. And also who I am and who I want to be. I've never met someone so full of love. Your example was so powerful. It didn't take months or years. The footprints you've left in my heart are some of the deepest I've ever known. They're here to stay. Losing you was so hard, and yet how could I be so selfish? To ask for more than you've given me, which was more than I ever thought possible. You are one of my best friends. Love.
This is Cold, Episode 1, To All the Girls I've Loved Before. I'm Dave Cawley.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
You can power up your playtime with the Nintendo Switch system, the home of Mario and friends. You may discover exciting surprises with Mario, Princess Peach, and more in Super Mario Bros. Wonder. Or challenge friends to a race in Mario Kart 8 Deluxe. You can head to Nintendo.com to learn more about the Nintendo Switch system. Games and systems sold separately.
Let me take just a second here. That voice you just heard belonged to Josh Powell. He recorded that sometime in 1999, part of a series of audio journals he kept during his early 20s. Those recordings have never been made public, until now. It's almost a foregone conclusion that Josh killed his wife, Susan, in December of 2009. He told police he had taken their two boys out for a desert camping trip, in a blizzard, after midnight. When they returned the next afternoon, Susan was nowhere to be found. Her body has never been located. Nearly 2 years later, as police closed in, Josh killed himself and his sons. This podcast is the result of an investigation spanning more than 3 years and 5 Western states. It's involved the review of tens of thousands of pages of police reports, warrants, emails, social worker notes, psychological evaluations, personal journals, and more. Everything you're going to hear has been carefully sourced. Where possible, I will bring you the actual voices of the people who were involved. In some cases, narrators will stand in for the key players. We've identified 3 themes in this investigation. First, Susan did see warning signs, but chose to ignore them. She, like so many women, stayed in an abusive relationship. Why? We can learn from her experience. Second, it seemed obvious to almost everyone that Josh killed Susan, yet police never arrested him. Why not? We're going to dissect the investigation to find those missed opportunities. And third, why did Josh do what he did? To answer that question, we have to look deep into his past and at the manipulative father who helped mold his monstrous actions. Steve and Teresa Powell gave birth to their second child, their first boy, on January 20th of 1976. Little Josh had an older sister, Jennifer, and was soon followed by a younger brother, John. When Josh turned 5, he decided he hated his kindergarten teacher because she failed his finger painting. Steve Powell baptized Josh into the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints when Josh turned 8, even though Steve wasn't worthy to perform the rite or to hold the church's priesthood. Steve's own journals, which I've read, and an outline for his autobiography confirm he had secretly gone apostate. By that point, Steve and Terry had bought a relatively spacious 2,700-square-foot home in the Spokane, Washington suburb of Varadale. It sat on a one-acre lot, giving their kids plenty of space to play. That was even more important as they added another child to the mix, Michael. Josh attended Franklin Elementary School. He was a bright kid who developed a love for robots, remote-controlled toys, electronics, and architecture. In the 4th grade, he figured out all by himself how to calculate the volume of the school's sandbox. The next year, he explained long division to a friend, even though no one had actually taught him how to do it. Yet Josh struggled with school, especially math. He didn't do well with the structure of the classroom. Life at home wasn't great either. When Josh was in the 5th grade, his mom discovered a secret journal Steve had been keeping. Steve had written hundreds of pages about the wife of another man. The journal entries represented 2 years of Steve's explicit sexual fantasies about that woman. Terry confronted her husband about the journal. Steve said if the woman's husband were to die, he would take her in as a plural wife and raise her kids. Terry was 8 months pregnant with her youngest child, Alina, at the time. In divorce papers filed years later, she would claim she feared Steve intended to bump off the other woman's husband in order to live out his fantasies. Steve showed no remorse for the hurt he had caused, but promised to change when Terry threatened to leave him. From the outside, the Powells still looked like the typical Latter-day Saint family. They went to church on Sundays and did stuff together. Steve, though, decided to feed his kids some decidedly different beliefs. He told the boys people were just animals and should be able to have sex with anyone at any time. He also kept porn magazines in the house. Worse yet, he found himself attracted to his oldest daughter, Jennifer. Many years later, Steve would write about those feelings in his journal.
I remember many times sitting at the breakfast bar in our home when she would come into the kitchen in the morning, dressed in a t-shirt and panties. That would drive me nuts. We went on a trip one time, just the two of us, and she wandered around our hotel room in nothing more than a bra and panties.
Steve wanted to tear Jennifer away from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. When she became a teen, he told her the church's scripture, the Book of Mormon, was false. Terry found out about that conversation and was so upset, she moved out of the house.
When I was about 14, my mom pulled me aside and she had a conversation with me. And she said, look at this path that your father is going on. Look at the path that our Savior wants you to go on, that the gospel will lead you down. Compare them. Where do you want to end up?
Jennifer told me that was a turning point.
That was the moment where I finally made a hard and fast decision. I didn't want to be like my dad. I could see that he was going down the wrong path, and he was making some bad choices, and he was treating his family badly and treating my mother badly. And I didn't want to be like that.
The other kids were younger and more impressionable. Josh had discovered a love for the Boy Scouts. He reveled at earning merit badges and enjoyed going on campouts with his troop. Steve didn't like it because the troop was sponsored by the church. He mocked his son until Josh, in shame, quit. Steve also sought out other anti-Mormons.
He had left the church and he was actively fighting against it. He was writing for anti-LDS magazines and was campaigning big time in his own little ways against the church. And he was doing this with his children too.
When Michael turned 8 and became eligible to be baptized, Steve refused. The family turmoil took a toll on Josh. Divorce court records show that around 1989, when Josh was 13, he threatened his mom with a butcher's knife. He also killed his 4-year-old sister Alina's pet gerbils, then made her touch their blood. Even worse, Terry said she once caught Josh and John examining Alina. Josh even tried to hang himself when he was 14. The suicide attempt left him with a rope burn on his neck. Terry pushed him into counseling. Steve and Terry tried to work out their marriage. They entered counseling. Terry moved back home, and things did seem to get better for a time. But it didn't last. One night, Jennifer was working on a project using the family's sewing machine. It took longer than she expected, so she decided to return to it the next morning. Her brother John wanted to use the sewing machine that night. Steve started to tear Jennifer's work out of the machine. When she protested, he smacked her in the face. Around this time, Josh became involved with a youth folk dance group called Silver Spurs. He met a girl named Sarah there. They spent a lot of time together in the spring of 1992 after Josh turned 16. For the most part, it was just innocent teenage stuff. They had long talks and snuck out of their homes at night to hang out together. Sarah was a couple of years older. She thought of Josh like a kid brother. His intentions skewed more to the romantic. He pressured her to be his girlfriend. Sarah explained, in no uncertain terms, she was not interested. Not only that, she'd be leaving at the start of summer, moving to Wyoming with her mom. It didn't make sense to start a relationship. But Josh persisted. One day shortly before Sarah left, he kissed her. She didn't like it, but hoped that by letting it happen, Josh would let her go gracefully. One night in May, Josh wanted to attend a youth get-together at church. Steve refused and grounded him. Josh went anyway. That night, he wrote his dad a letter explaining he intended to move out and live in his car.
You say that I'd probably be more unhappy, but I'm gonna find out. I think it's going to work out. Maybe we can be better friends this way.
Josh didn't stay out of the house for long. That summer, he got a job working at a neighborhood car wash. One day, while on shift, money went missing from one of the cars. Josh swore he didn't take it, but even his own dad didn't believe it. Josh was fired. It was the first of what would turn out to be a lifetime of failures in business. Josh could tell something was wrong. He looked over at his dad from the passenger seat of the car. Steve didn't look like himself. He seemed preoccupied, distant. The car rolled up Progress Road, past homes with Halloween decorations taped into the windows. "Have you and Mom been talking about divorce again?" he asked. The question hung in the air. The car kept moving north toward I-90 and the Spokane River. "She filed for divorce today," Steve replied. That answer flattened Josh like a punch from a prize fighter. He knew his parents' relationship was bad, but he wasn't privy to all of the dirty details of his father's private life. He went to school that day, going through the motions while attempting to process what his dad had said. A bitterness started to grow. He wondered why his mom would do such a thing. The only reason he could think of was her religion. When Josh returned home from school that afternoon, he found his mom and uncle sitting in the living room. The bishop of their Latter-day Saint ward, their congregation, was there as well. "Your dad and I are getting a divorce, and I'm keeping the house," Terry said. She told her oldest son he was welcome to keep living there, but would have to abide by some new rules. She handed him a sheet of paper. "No swearing or crude talk. No R-rated movies. Curfew at 11 p.m. At the bottom, Josh read, "If you break any of these rules, Mom reserves the right to throw you out." A rising sense of fury made his hands shake. Terry wanted him to sign the paper, indicating he understood. Josh looked around the room, from his mom to his burly uncles to the bishop. "I don't care about your rules, because I'm living with Dad," he said. Then Josh ran up the stairs to his bedroom. "I don't care where I live. I'm not living with you," he shouted. Josh left the house that evening with his brother John. They were going to a friend's birthday party. As they walked out the door, Terry warned her boys to be back by 11. Josh said they wouldn't be able to do that. "You'd better be back by then, or the doors may just be locked," Terry said. Josh resented his mother's newfound sense of authority. He had no intention of abiding by her curfew. He and John caught a bus uptown. As the party started to wind down that night, Josh began to wonder whether or not the threat his mom had made actually bore any teeth. At 10:30, he called home to ask if the door would actually be locked by the time he made it home. "Why don't you just come home and we'll see," Terry said. "Well, I guess I won't come home then," Josh said and slammed down the phone. He didn't go home that night or the next day. Instead, he crashed with a friend for a few days. His dad finally tracked him down. Through tears, Steve told Josh he'd been worried sick. Steve said he'd rented an apartment, Jennifer, Michael, and Alina were still at home with Terry, but 15-year-old John was living with him. Steve wanted Josh to come stay in the apartment as well. Josh agreed. Steve did not take the divorce gracefully. He lashed out at Terry in court filings, calling her a religious freak. He claimed her faith had crossed over into the occult, and he used the loyalty of his sons to his advantage. Steve took Josh and John to his paralegal and had them file declarations supporting him. This is what Josh wrote.
We also seem to do an awful amount of arguing over religion and where and when we have to go to church and what we have to believe. I feel that it is a lot of scare tactics and brainwashing and think the younger kids should be protected from that.
Steve even had Michael, then just 10 years old, file an affidavit. The judge was not impressed, calling the involvement of the boys in the case concerning. Even more concerning were the claims Josh's older sister Jenny offered the court. In early November, Steve, Josh, and John came over to the house. Terry was gathering some legal papers when Steve tried to grab them out of her hand. Terry resisted. The confrontation turned physical. Jennifer felt afraid and called 911. Steve, seeing her on the phone, told her to hang up. Jennifer dropped the phone but grabbed the folder and ran out of the house. She headed for her car where she intended to lock the court papers out of her father's reach. She didn't make it to the car. Josh tackled Jenny on the front lawn, wrapping his arms around her and overpowering her. Steve reached the front door and saw his kids wrestling and shouting at one another in full view of the neighbors. It looked bad. He yelled at Josh to let go of Jennifer and come back inside the house. Terry and Jennifer told the court Steve and the boys were trying to brainwash Michael and turn him against his mom. Josh said the house was segregated, girls versus boys. Terry said both Josh and John had hit her in the past. Steve told the court his wife and oldest daughter, they were just telling stories.
He totally had them convinced that my mom was just twisting the facts when in reality it was my dad that had everything twisted out of shape. And he was amazing at that.
At first, the judge allowed Steve access to the home because it was where he kept his office. Steve used that permission, though, as carte blanche to do whatever he wanted. When Terry put a padlock on her bedroom door, Steve tried to cut it. Steve flew into a rage one day when Jennifer stopped him from taking a chair out of the house. He grabbed her by the hair, pulling so hard, some strands separated from her scalp. In light of the violence, the judge granted Terry custody of both Michael and Alina. Josh and John were allowed to choose where they wanted to live. Both decided to stay with Steve. Josh wrote a journal entry around that time. He called his mom a treasure seeker who wanted to bleed Steve for all he was worth. He called his sister Jennifer a witch. Now, all of this was going on while Josh was an 11th grader at Central Valley High School. He did his best to keep up with his classwork in spite of the chaos. In the journal entry, he wrote,
"Last week I took a test in algebra and I couldn't concentrate. Couldn't even figure out some of the problems. Algebra is my best subject."
Josh wrote his mother was the reason he had had to see a shrink more than once in the past, but didn't go into detail about his self-harm or threatening behavior. His personal relationships also suffered. Just a few weeks after learning of his parents' divorce, he responded to a letter from Sarah, the girl that he had surprised with an unwanted kiss earlier that year. Sarah had gone off to college in Wyoming and wrote to Josh about how different college life was from high school. Josh felt like she was talking down to him, and he was livid.
"I've never said anything before when you offended me. I assumed it would stop. It will stop. If you have to keep saying other people are better than me, then don't. Say it to someone else."
This was a major shift in tone. Josh's prior letters to Sarah had been meek, almost puppy dogish. He seemed to recognize that his emotions were just running out of control.
"Sorry if I seem like a jerk. I'm just mad. I'm tired of you patronizing me. I'm better than most of the people I know. I'm not being conceited either. It's just a fact. It's about time you realize it."
For all of this anger, there were also hints of an internal conflict. Terry told the court there were times when Josh seemed troubled by the way Steve and John acted. She wrote in one declaration that Josh's anger seemed to flare and subside. He was capable, she said, of thoughtfulness and cooperation. In April of 1993, Josh wrote a letter to Sarah's sister, Teresa. He complained about the divorce and, in particular, his mom.
"I would kind of like my mom to be dead. Shh.
Steve kept pushing boundaries. He repeatedly showed up at Michael and Alina's school. He would take them off campus for lunch, even though he didn't have legal custody. Steve told the kids it was their mom, not the courts, that kept them apart. One time, Steve kept Michael for a full week beyond his court-authorized visitation. Terry worried Steve might try to actually kidnap the younger kids. She told the court Steve's own parents had played what they called the kidnap game with Steve when he was a child.
You know, there's a pattern of abuse there that escalated through generations. My dad's parents divorced when he was pretty young, and then they played this game of kidnapping the children from each other. And they would just see how long they could hide the children from the other parent.
Jennifer told me that didn't happen with her siblings, at least not exactly.
My dad didn't physically kidnap the children, but he did that in this mental way, with this game that he would play mentally, where he would twist all the facts and make them believe that my mother was terrible. And so in a sense, he was kidnapping them mentally.
Steve told the older boys Terry's home was their home too. They should come and go as they wished. Terry didn't see it that way. On Mother's Day, Josh and John went over to the house and tried to force their way inside. Terry called the police. Steve moved to Puyallup at the beginning of 1994. Josh by then was a high school senior and turning 18. He, John, and Michael made the move to Western Washington as well. Josh had only a few months to go to graduation, but the move to Puyallup sapped him of motivation. He ended up at Rogers High School, where he didn't know anyone and had no friends. He'd left a girlfriend behind in Spokane, but any idea of maintaining a long-distance relationship, it disappeared when he met a girl named Mary Cox. Mary also attended Rogers High. Josh wanted to date Mary, but she wasn't interested. Josh managed to graduate high school. Afterward, he took a job working at a cabinet shop in the nearby city of Kent. He also tried to promote his own woodworking business, Powell Custom Furniture, which he operated out of a storage unit. That fall, Josh started classes at Pierce College. Steve's move to Puyallup didn't bring calm to the Powell family. He chafed against the judge's orders and found himself in contempt of court for not paying the bills and child support. Steve reported Terry to Child Protective Services, claiming she'd neglected Michael and Alina. The state launched an investigation and decided Steve's accusation was unfounded. The Powell family reunited in August of 1994 when Jennifer, the oldest of the kids, married Kirk Graves in the Portland, Oregon temple of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Steve was absent. Jennifer refused to invite her dad, a slight which he never forgave. Kirk and Jennifer had been together for about 6 months before tying the knot. Josh said he didn't expect their marriage to last in a letter to his friend, Teresa.
If I were to place a wager on the outcome of their marriage, I would have to bet against longevity. Who knows? Maybe they'll beat the odds.
In March of 1995, Josh bought a motorcycle. The bike was nothing too flashy, a Yamaha Radian, but it did make getting around between home, school, and work a bit easier. It was also cheaper than a car, and Josh liked the feeling of speed. Josh disliked living with his dad. Steve encouraged arguments among the kids, especially over religion. The house was a hostile place, not somewhere Josh wanted to bring friends. Not that Josh had many friends to hang out with. He really didn't meet anyone at Pierce College. Mary Cox wasn't the only girl to spurn him, either. He struck out over and over again in his efforts to find a girlfriend. In the fall of 1995, he did meet a girl named Becky in his macroeconomics class. They hit it off, but Josh was reluctant to get too attached. He later wrote,
"Becky liked to go dancing at the club with her girlfriends. I think dancing is an intimate activity to be shared with a loved one. I tend not to see the point in dancing with strangers. Becky also enjoyed the occasional drink. She went to bars with her girlfriends. One time while I knew her, she went by herself since her friends weren't available. I think this is not a ladylike activity. I've decided to direct more energy to finding a girl who has similar attitudes on love, intimacy, time, education, alcohol, and such issues."
Josh did well in school, keeping a GPA just below 4.0. That was impressive, considering he frequently slept through classes. The one exception was a course on American Sign Language, which he loved. After completing his associate's degree at Pierce College, Josh enrolled at the University of Washington in Seattle. His goal? Become an architect. Josh rented a dorm at Stevens Court for the fall semester of 1996. He was thrilled to find an Ethernet jack in his room. It was a much faster internet connection than his dial-up modem at home. He connected his computer, set up his first email account, and marveled at the ability to access an entire encyclopedia on CD. His excitement for the university experience didn't last. On his fifth day on campus, Josh's dorm mates decided to throw a back-to-school bash. About 75 people crammed into the small apartment. They passed around beer and bud, encouraging Josh to drink and smoke pot with them. He refused. At one point, an inebriated roommate slammed Josh to the ground. The blow did more damage to Josh's pride than his body, but the bullying wasn't just physical. During another party, Josh's roommates told him one of the guests was gay and wanted to have sex with him. They were explicit in their description. "Isn't that why you're in college?" they asked, "to experience new things?" Josh didn't quite know how to handle their taunts. He requested a room transfer, but it took weeks for the university to approve. Meantime, he fell behind in his classes. In November, he wrote a letter to the university.
"Throughout my stay in that first apartment, I was bombarded with loud noises at all hours of the night. I was the subject of a sick joke that became sexual harassment. My personal belongings were stolen by my roommates or their guests, and I was the victim of assault and battery."
The transfer did finally come through. Josh found his second apartment at Stevens Court, quiet and clean. His new roommate was an international student from India. They became fast friends. Josh joined a yacht club and took a drama class. On some nights, he let off steam by walking a couple of blocks down to the edge of Portage Bay. Josh was living on his own for the first time in his life. It brought things into focus. He confided to his friend Teresa that his dad was a bad influence.
"My dad seems to always get mad at me when he sees me. My brother and I concluded that my dad resents me. He often says rude things to and about me. Actually, the things he says are not true. He perceives them because he wants to. I try not to get mad. But it's hard sometimes."
A month later, Josh told Teresa he'd heard a story on the radio about depression. He believed he was depressed. Josh's mom, Terry, was also in school. She'd married Steve right out of high school and had never gone to college, instead staying home to raise her five kids. After the divorce, Steve repeatedly refused to pay child support or his portion of the bills. Terry had to make a living, so she enrolled in college. It wasn't enough. She actually had to ask the church for financial assistance. Steve took notice of that. He demanded she pay him child support, even though his earnings far outpaced hers. He also renewed his efforts to gain custody of Alina. At the start of 1997, Josh abandoned his ambitions in architecture. He decided to go all in on drama, which he had really enjoyed in high school. He signed up for a theater class at UW and tried out for a play, winning a part in a production of Lil Abner. His role was a crony. I mean, it wasn't even a speaking part. Friends told Josh they were excited for him, but it must have come as a blow to his ego. He abandoned any aspirations of pursuing a career as an actor. His feelings of apathy and depression did not go away.
If you struggle to get in shape and lose weight, I'm about to change your life. I'm Carl, the CEO of Body, and I don't like working out and eating healthy either. So here's how I get myself to do it. I make myself own the morning. And by the morning, I mean the first hour or so every day. It's not family time. It's not for scrolling social media. It's for my results and my health. And man, does it work. Every day, I get out of bed, drink a health shake I made the night before, and then I go crush a workout in the Body app and just follow along day by day. Before most people are even out of bed, I'm done for the day. So here's my offer to you. If you sign up for a one-year subscription to Body, I'll give you 65% off. 65%! Because I want you to start now and see how fast the pounds come off and the muscles start popping. And if they don't, hey, you get your money back. But the sale ends this week, so don't wait. Sign up for a year of Body and save 65%. Just go to body.com. That's BODI.com. And let's own the morning together and get healthy and fit.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, snack lovers. Curb your cravings with My Mochi ice cream. Imagine a scoop of rich, creamy, premium ice cream in your favorite flavor. Now imagine that scoop wrapped up in the sweetest, softest dough known to mankind. That's My Mochi ice cream. Sweet, chewy, cool, and creamy, all in one bite. It's quite possibly the most joyfully chill sensation you've ever had in your life. My Mochi ice cream comes in tons of fabulous flavors, like strawberry, mango, cookies and cream, and double chocolate. Each box of My Mochi ice cream has 6 perfectly portioned mochis that are about 80 calories each, and it's also gluten-free. You can find My Mochi at Target or visit MyMochi.com to find a grocery store near you. That's MyMochi.com. Discover the joyfully chill sensation of My Mochi ice cream today.
One experience at the University of Washington changed Josh more than any other. One day during the spring of 1997, he walked by a window and saw a pretty young woman sitting on the other side of the glass. She glanced up at him. Josh smiled. The woman smiled back, so Josh dropped what he was doing and went to introduce himself. Understand, Josh was never shy around girls. He overflowed with confidence and felt no apprehension about approaching total strangers. This time, he discovered the woman was a member of a group called Campus Crusade for Christ. She invited Josh to spend time with her friends, who were all born-again Christians. Here's what he wrote about that experience in a later letter.
One of their celebrations was in a big lodge where whole families were invited. Many of us were sitting on the floor. A cute little black baby boy came up to me and sat on my lap. He said, "I love you." I knew he did, and in my heart, he was the only one who did love me at the time.
Remember, Josh was feeling secretly depressed, and he was moved. He asked his new friends to make him born again. Soon the semester ended. Josh moved out of his campus apartment and back in with his dad in Puyallup. They didn't get along, especially as Josh began to question the absence of religion from his life. His turn inward also revealed to Josh just how poorly he'd treated his mom as a teenager. Instead of returning to school that fall, he went back to Verdale to patch up his relationship with Terry. The escape from Steve's orbit had a pretty profound effect on Josh. He examined his life, questioning why it always seemed so hard for him to connect with people, especially girls. Here's what he wrote about it that September.
I think certain aspects of my character can use improvement. I may be a much easier person to be around with these minor adjustments. For instance, I say what I think. Sometimes I need to remember that people don't want to hear some things.
Josh reconnected with cousins on his mom's side of the family. They, like that little boy at the Campus Crusade for Christ retreat, showed him unconditional love. Terry encouraged her oldest son to attend some of the events for young adults put on by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
My mom suggested that I go to family home evening. I decided to go hang out there until I could make some real friends at Eastern Washington University. But as I went each week, I found my old friends from junior high school. They were nice to me, and I made real friends in spite of the fact that I told them that I was not at all interested in their church.
Josh's entire demeanor seemed to change. His sister Jennifer saw it.
I don't know what it was. It seemed like for just a little short time, there was a little bit of a glimmer of light that came in to Josh's mind and heart.
That November, Josh's old friend turned pen pal, Jackie, wrote him a letter asking about this sudden spiritual awakening. "Kind of shocked me when you started talking about it," Jackie wrote. "You used to be so rebellious about it, mostly because of your mom." But Josh no longer resented his mom. He forgave her for the divorce and even started patching up the bruised relationship with Jennifer.
He started going back to church and just overall, I would talk to him occasionally too, and he just sounded like he was doing better, on a better path.
At the start of 1998, Josh enrolled in school again, this time at Eastern Washington University. He didn't plan to stay there very long. He wanted to move to Utah, just like Jennifer had. But before that could happen, Josh met a young woman named Catherine Terry. You heard a little from Catherine at the start of this episode. Here's the rest of her story. Catherine had grown up in Utah. She'd only moved to Spokane after graduating high school. Her aunt and uncle had invited her up to live with them, knowing she was coming off a bad breakup and was in need of a fresh start. Catherine was an active member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. In Spokane, she started attending a singles ward. That's a congregation for unmarried church members. And that's how she met Josh.
I think I went to, the first time I met him was an activity that we went to. And of course, you know, he immediately came up to me and introduced himself, you know, and of course, you know, at the time I was young and naive and quite smitten by him, you know, and he was really odd about the beginning of our relationship because he's just like, I just want to be friends, you know, nothing more than that. I'm not looking for anything more than that. And so it's like, because I was interested in him and obviously he was interested in me, and it went from there to a relationship.
When Josh left to visit Jennifer in Utah for a few weeks, he spent every night talking to Catherine on the phone. It all moved too fast for Josh, though. At one point, he told Catherine they needed to break up. She was crushed. Josh returned from Utah a short time later and told her he still wanted to be friends. Catherine sucked it up and agreed. But Josh soon decided he wasn't happy just being friends. He went to work reestablishing the relationship. Catherine was hesitant, but she caved to pressure. She was 19, Josh was 22. From that point, their relationship progressed very quickly. Josh asked Catherine to move in with him. Catherine's uncle told her shacking up with Josh was a bad idea. He said she needed to stay well away from Josh Powell. She ignored that advice. Josh and Catherine spent the summer of 1998 living with Steve Powell in Puyallup. Josh was spending money freely, buying CDs and DVDs, kitchen appliances, a futon, and all manner of other things. When he ran out of money, no problem. He spent what little Catherine had. When his old friend Jackie invited him to her wedding in North Dakota, Josh discovered he couldn't afford the price of a bus ticket.
I went to the Greyhound station Sunday to buy tickets, but my credit card was rejected. At the moment, I have absolutely no cash. I guess I've been spending more than I thought since I met Catherine.
Catherine met the rest of Josh's family, with the exception of his older sister Jenny, who had moved to Utah. Josh's kid sister, Alina, seemed to live on her computer, but she and Catherine, they got along pretty well. John, she said, was standoffish. Michael, Catherine thought, was quiet and sensitive.
Mike, when we were there, he kind of followed Josh around like a puppy dog, you know. But, yeah, anytime I, you know, even hung around, I think mainly his brothers on a one-on-one basis, Josh would come unglued and he'd be like, I don't want you hanging out with them, you know. I'm pretty sure he probably told me a bunch of stuff, you know, that wasn't true to get me to not have anything to do with them.
Josh didn't talk to Catherine much about his family's history. He didn't go into detail about the divorce. As far as Catherine could tell, Josh's dad, he was a nice guy. Steve was almost like a father figure, very kind to her and understanding.
He and Josh, they clashed a lot. They butted heads a lot. And I don't know if it's just because Steve expected more of Josh. But yeah, there were times where, you know, they would get into it, yelling about this, that, and the other. And
Josh and Catherine didn't stay in Puyallup for more than a few months. They found an apartment for themselves in Seattle. Josh re-enrolled at UW for the fall semester, and he encouraged Catherine to do the same, but she couldn't qualify for in-state tuition. So instead, she signed up for classes at a nearby community college. Catherine had no job and no money for tuition. Josh told her to get a student loan, so she did. When the check came, Josh took it and deposited it into his own account. Catherine never saw that money. In fact, get this, she still owes on that debt to this day, 20 years later. Josh picked up a job installing furniture for his dad. Catherine occasionally pitched in there as well.
I just remember every time I got my check, he'd have me sign it, and then he'd stick it in his account.
Their apartment was tiny. Anytime it rained, which was often in Seattle, the roof leaked. Josh wanted to sue his landlord and started reading about the law.
I may as well be a lawyer. It's so easy.
In November, Josh wrote a letter to his Aunt Brenda about his problems with the apartment. It turned into a rant about the legal system.
I am considering becoming a lawyer because I have no respect for that ilk. I would not be afraid to slaughter my opponents. I would go after bad people of all sorts, especially lawyers and judges.
This was the old Josh, not the young man who had had the spiritual awakening. Still, he and Catherine continued to attend church meetings. They joined a congregation for families, even though they weren't married.
It was weird to me because he's just like, if anybody asks if we're married, don't say no. And I mean, I even remember wearing, you know, just a band on my finger.
Josh told Catherine he didn't want to get married and really never wanted to have kids. Catherine felt very uneasy about the situation. She knew they were not living the religion, but Josh wanted others to think that they were.
We were active, but I do just remember feeling so out of place and like, this is not what we should be doing. You know, if we're living together and we're not married, we shouldn't be going to church together like this and making people think that we're married.
Those church meetings should have acted as a social outlet for Catherine, but it really didn't work out that way. Anytime she started to make friends, Josh would intervene.
And it was basically his family, him, and school. That was it.
They had a landline phone in the apartment, but no cell phones. Josh rarely allowed Catherine to use his computer.
I couldn't get on it unless he was there. The only thing I ever really did on it was to email my friend. And of course, he sat right next to me as I emailed my friend, reading everything that I wrote. Okaying it, basically, before I send it.
Josh also made sure to read her journal. The only transportation they had was Josh's motorcycle or the city bus. Catherine didn't know how to drive a motorcycle, and Josh never offered to teach her.
I came up with this idea when we go grocery shopping to ask the grocery store for a large plastic bag, and we would put all of our groceries in it.
Oh.
He would put it in front of himself on his bike, and then he'd be on his bike, and I'd be on the bike, and we would go back home. And I can't remember how many times we did that, but I'm just like, this is insane.
You know, in effect, Josh made Catherine a prisoner. Yet she kept telling herself she was happy. She was lying to herself.
I remember one time getting into a fight with him, and there was nowhere to go but the bathroom. And I went and locked myself in there, and I remember putting my feet up against the door and him unlocking the door and pushing with all of his might to get into me.
Josh's control over Catherine wasn't always so physical. One time while they were living together, Catherine went to have her nails done. She felt pretty and proud of herself.
And then he noticed that I had gotten my nails done and told me how stupid it was and how much he hated it. And I remember him being gone to do something and ripping these nails off my fingers in order to appease him, only to have to go back to the salon to have them fix the damage that I had done.
That damage, it was a lot worse than Catherine understood at first.
I remember a night where it was like right after I had them fixed, and I could feel an infection in one of my fingers, and waking up just crying, and him not doing anything about it. He didn't care, you know? And just laying there and just being like, you did it to yourself, basically.
Catherine's uncle back in Spokane died while she was living in the Seattle apartment. Her whole family gathered for the funeral. Josh refused to let her go. Josh's dad even came to Catherine's defense, offering to pay her way to Spokane, but Josh wouldn't hear of it. Catherine told me Josh hated her uncle for having tried to keep them apart.
I was so devastated because I was just like, you know, no matter how much I tried to persuade him to be like, just let me go. You know, I'm going to come back. He was like, no.
In March of 1999, Catherine decided to take a trip home to Utah to visit a friend. Josh's school schedule prevented him from joining.
It was when I got away, you know, from him, and I didn't realize how much control he had over how I was and what I did and what I didn't do and stuff like that. But
Catherine realized how unhappy she'd become living with Josh. She decided not to return to Washington. She made a phone call to Josh and told him she would not be coming back. Josh put her stuff in storage until she could come up and get it. She made that trip the weekend before Thanksgiving. Josh insisted on seeing Catherine the night she and her new boyfriend, Dennis, arrived in Seattle. You heard how that played out at the beginning of this episode. When Josh got home from that face-to-face with Dennis and Catherine at their hotel, he scribbled a short note on a scrap of paper. Here's what he wrote.
Her fiancé was a jerk. He seemed like a possessive freak, like a bouncer.
That was one of the few clues I had that led me to Catherine. I met she and Dennis at their house in Utah on a hot summer afternoon in 2018.
Come on in.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Hey, you
guys, the window-mounted air conditioner droned as we talked. I'd printed out a copy of the note and showed it to them.
Holy smokes, this is when we were there. This is the weekend we were there.
Dennis and Catherine are married now.
I don't want to read it. I'm good. You can tell me about it later, because I'm pretty sure he will. Be like, hey, we need to talk about this.
Let's jump back again to 1999. Now, the day after Josh dropped off the Science Center pass was Sunday. Dennis and Catherine drove around Seattle together. She showed him where she had lived, and he took her out to the suburbs, where he had served a 2-year mission for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Josh went to church himself that day. Then he drove his dad's minivan to the storage unit where he had stashed Catherine's things. They all met that evening in the parking lot of a Petco store just off the I-5 freeway, not far from the University of Washington campus. It was also near the apartment Josh and Catherine had shared for about 6 months. Josh was wearing what he always wore, a white t-shirt, denim pants, sneakers, and a black leather jacket.
He shows up in, I guess, his dad's van, a Windstar, or something like that, and we got all the stuff out, and he's been really helpful again. He was, helping us get everything to fit.
It was a challenge, but they managed to cram it all into Dennis's car. When they were done, Catherine told Josh goodbye, for good, and sat down in the passenger seat. Dennis put the car in drive and pulled out of the lot, keeping an eye on the side mirror.
I looked back at him, and I think he was waiting for a little while to leave, because I think he was just kind of taking it in. Because I think there was just still that small hope that he might be able to pull something off, because I don't think he was over her completely yet. I mean, even though he wanted to give off the impression he was. But that was that.
The feeling of apprehension Catherine had felt on her way into Seattle bled out of her on the drive back home to Utah. A different emotion replaced it. Relief. She had escaped. She thought she would never have to see Josh Powell's face again. Josh took some time to reflect on the implosion of their relationship. He decided it had fallen apart because he had stopped living his faith. Josh wanted to stay in Seattle, but he could not afford his own place, so he recruited some roommates from among his church friends. They moved into a place just west of the UW campus. Josh was not an easy guy to live with. He insisted on doing all of the grocery shopping himself, but he became upset when his roommates ate any of the food. In May of 1999, Josh met a girl at church. Let's call her Cindy. It's not her real name, but I'm using it to protect her privacy. Now, Cindy had two sisters. I will call them Stella and Jamie, also not their real names. Cindy was half Brazilian and spoke fluent Portuguese. Josh started listening to audio tapes in an effort to learn the language. He started pressuring Cindy to date him. He showed up at her family's house, unannounced, late one Tuesday evening. Here's Josh's own voice from his audio journal.
My general experience is that most girls hate that. But then that's the way I am. It's the way I would like to be.
He asked Cindy to step outside so that they could talk. And then he droned on and on, keeping her out past her 11:30 curfew.
But I think I will need to be more careful in the future because I really don't want to get her into trouble. I think it would be too bad to add stress to our relationship unnecessarily. And the concept of curfew is not familiar to me.
The next day, Josh wrote Cindy a long letter describing his time with Catherine and his brief fall away from faith.
After I came to the church, I had one big struggle and I lost hold for a while. I think even that was for my good, though. The sun went down and I was alone. Only when I returned again was I free again.
He wrote another letter a few days later, confessing the turmoil of his parents' divorce. He said he finally understood his sister Jennifer's split from the rest of the family.
She endured the second worst thing in the world. She made a choice to distance herself from my dad. So now I will face the second hardest thing in the world. It is up to my dad when I will see him and how much.
Cindy didn't have romantic feelings for Josh. She asked him not to show up at the house without calling first. But he kept finding excuses to visit, like dropping off some CDs or bringing over a pot for a plant. Again, this is Josh's audio journal.
I hadn't really scheduled it. I just called her like an hour before I arrived, and I just left it on the voicemail. So I had done what she asked me in my own little way.
Cindy finally had to make it clear she was not interested. Josh told her he wanted to stay friends. Then, over the next few months, he slowly shifted his interest down the line to Cindy's sister, Stella. Josh's journals reveal he knew this was abnormal behavior. This is from Josh's written journal.
If there is a girl who is interested in my brother, and then she got interested in me, I would probably be very cautious with her too. I might feel like I was her second choice.
It didn't stop him. Josh's feelings for Stella grew into a raging fire he just couldn't seem to control. He continued to show up at her house or at her work, sometimes carrying a video camera. It made Stella uneasy. Josh, meanwhile, was dealing with feelings of jealousy and isolation.
Sometimes I feel like no one wants to be around me. It is as though I am not allowed to feel sad sometimes. I think a lot of people don't understand that I have the same feelings as everyone else.
In early October, Josh decided it was time to confront Stella. He brought her flowers and told her he wanted to be her boyfriend. He asked her to pray about him.
Ask your father about me. And if there's any chance I might be good for you, then please don't start dating anyone else.
Stella, like her sister, felt put off by Josh's high-pressure approach. She told him they should just stay friends. Josh did back off for about a month. He tried dating around a bit, but struck out again. He began to blame his dating troubles on his roommates, who he saw as freeloaders.
They don't seem to appreciate all the things I do for them. I owe them nothing. It makes me want to unshare and get rid of them.
In December, Josh poured his heart out to Stella in an email. As he'd done with Cindy, he described how his mom and dad's divorce had scarred him. He talked about finding his way back to religion. He even made a veiled reference to Catherine, his ex-girlfriend, calling her the first girl that he had ever really liked deep down. At the end, he told Stella she was then the sole object of his attention.
I want you to love me, Stella. I love you. When you said you wanted to be friends, I tried to get over you, but no other girl comes close. The only thing I don't love about you is that I can't reach you.
But one of Josh's roommates had secretly warned Cindy about what he was really like. Cindy talked to Stella. Word got back to Josh. He was furious over what he called his roommate's indiscretion.
I just want them gone so I don't mind being a nuisance to them. Boy, will I be happy when they aren't wearing out my nice things anymore. I probably shouldn't get too mean with these guys because it could affect my reputation.
In January, Josh executed his plan. From the audio journal.
I let go of my apartment and I packed up all my stuff. I put it in my storage unit. I had a feeling I did not need to be in Seattle anymore. I had a feeling and it got stronger and stronger until I finally moved out of there. I didn't know where I needed to go. I didn't know what I was doing, where I was going. I didn't know anything.
Before leaving Seattle, Josh made a half-hearted attempt to woo Cindy and Stella's cousin. It did not go well.
I got away from a complicated situation with roommates and friends and complicated relationships crisscrossing every which way.
Josh moved back to his dad's place in Puyallup.
It is kind of difficult living with my dad at times because of his attitudes against the church. But I have thought about it and realized that it is even more difficult for my little brother and sister who have never tasted the gospel.
In March, Josh took a road trip to his sister Jennifer's house in Utah. He was there to attend the biannual general conference of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He was also there to meet a young woman he had found on a website for church singles.
I went down there to Utah to see her. Spent a couple of weeks and a few thousand miles furthest I've ever driven for a date. That was a great experience, although obviously it didn't work out.
That is an understatement. Let me explain why. Josh made just a couple of references to this woman in his writings. I found her full name buried in the thousands of files police later retrieved from his computer. Now, during our first conversation, this woman had told me something about Josh had given her the creeps. She couldn't put her finger on what. Josh's own journals may shed some light on it. After their date, Josh wrote about visiting the Provo, Utah temple. He saw young married couples there, with happy expressions on their faces. He thought it was the same look he had seen on the face of that girl that he had driven so far to meet.
We have had that understanding that when we are together, it is about each other. Even if I may not marry her, I was thinking about how sweet she is toward me.
He barely knew this girl. He bought her a rose and wrote a letter confessing his feelings. Are you seeing a pattern here? It was the same approach he had used unsuccessfully on the sisters in Seattle. He completely failed to understand she thought he was a weirdo. Josh didn't tell his sister Jennifer about those dates, even though he was staying at her house at the time. Jennifer didn't seem surprised when I told her about it.
He has always been just a little bit odd. During that period, I think that the oddness was maybe less pronounced, but it was still there. And we knew it.
Josh went back to Washington even more committed to his religion. It put him in direct conflict with his dad. Here's Josh's audio journal.
I was living with my dad for about 6 months until I finally got to the point where I couldn't take it anymore. My dad is, of course, non-member, and it was starting to wear me down to have to be around alcohol in the house and cussing and occasional anti-Mormon discussions. So my mom suggested that I get an apartment in Tacoma. Well, I hadn't really considered that because I wasn't planning on staying in Tacoma. I felt like I wanted to get the heck out of there.
So Josh found an apartment in Tacoma, this time by himself with no roommates. He joined the church's College Heights ward and enrolled in the business school at the University of Washington, Tacoma. He actually made new friends at church. There were a lot of girls in his orbit, but none wanted to get serious.
I often feel like I just can't get through to any girl that I really like, that the only girls that pay attention to me are the ones that I'm not interested in anyway.
That fall, he went to an institute class with his friend Tim Marini. Institutes of religion are sort of like seminaries. They are places where college-age church members go to study their faith and to socialize. At the end of one institute class, Josh spied a young girl who looked somewhat familiar.
Well, I didn't know who she was. She was about to leave after institute. I called her back and I was like, hey, come here. Talk to me for a while. And she did.
Her name was Susan Cox. As they chatted, she asked if he knew how to play the piano. Josh said, maybe a little. Susan said she remembered Josh having played the piano at her house years before. He'd come over to see her older sister, Mary. Again, are you seeing a pattern here? Josh made a habit of moving his affections from sister to sister whenever he was rebuffed. Susan would later write that Josh socially attacked her that day. He was 24, she was just barely 19, the same age Catherine had been when she first started dating Josh. Susan would soon become Catherine 2.0. On the next episode of Cold.
Tonight, I asked my sweet Susan to marry me, and she said yes.
If you haven't already, please subscribe to Cold. Toss us a rating or a review. You can find Cold on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Cold Podcast. For video clips, pictures from the case, and more, hit up thecoldpodcast.com. Also, if Susan's story sounds familiar in your own life, in other words, if you or someone you know is experiencing domestic abuse in any form, please get immediate help. In the U.S., support is a phone call away at the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233 or online at www.thehotline.org. A quick thank you to my team, Kristen Sorensen, Eric Openshaw, Ken Fall, Danielle Prager, Adam Mason, Jillian Friedman, and especially Cheryl Worsley for all of their help with this project. The music for Cold was composed by Michael Bonmiller, except for the guitar stuff. That was me. Cold is a KSL podcast. Thank you for listening. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Cold ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at listenerstudy.com.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.